AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Palestinian negotiators in Cairo have agreed to another 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza. Egypt calling for an end to the fighting as a way to get the Israelis back to the indirect talks. AP's Karen Loeb reports.
Israeli officials have said the Israeli negotiating team will not return to Gaza as long as there is rocket and mortar fire from Gaza at Israel. Now, over the past 2 days, dozens of rockets and mortar shells have been fired at Israel.
Hamas wants Israel to open Gaza borders and lift the blockade. Israel says that will only happen when Hamas and other militant groups disarm. NASCAR driver Tony Stewart will be back on the track today after killing another driver in an upstate New York sprint car race. Sagar Magani has more.
A Stewart Racing Team spokesman says Kevin Ward Jr.'s death during yesterday's race in Canandaigua was a tragic accident. The team manager says Stewart will drive today at Watkins Glen, calling the race business as usual. Ward was killed when he climbed from his car during the race and apparently tried to confront Stewart, whose car then hit him.
He was visibly shaken by this incident.
Ontario County Sheriff Philip Povero says police questioned Stewart before releasing him. I'm Sagar Magani.
Shortly after 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed yesterday by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, a St. Louis suburb, an angry crowd gathered, some yelling, "Kill the police." Little is known publicly about what led to Brown's shooting, other than what Dorian Johnson, who says he was with Brown, saw and heard.
He pulled out his weapon. His weapon was drawn, and he said, "I'll shoot you," or "I'm going to shoot." And in the same moment, the first shot went off.
That tape from KTVI-TV, a spokesman with the St. Louis County Police Department, which is investigating, confirms a Ferguson police officer did shoot Brown. This is AP Radio News. A 17-year-old has been arrested in the death and sexual assault of a 6-year-old girl whose body was found near the Bremerton, Washington mobile home park she vanished from last weekend. Sheriff's Detective Earl Smith.
The Washington State Patrol Crime Lab made positive confirmation of a suspect through forensic evidence that had been collected.
One resident of the mobile home park says news of the arrest doesn't bring her back, but it is still relief. State-run media in Iran report that 39 people are dead, 9 others injured in the crash of a passenger plane on takeoff in Tehran. The media reports that the plane suffered engine failure before it went down. Playing 2+1 in Anaheim, the Los Angeles Angels, Boston Red Sox spent more than 6 hours on the field before their game was decided early this morning. Albert Pujols' walk-off home run in the bottom of the 19th inning gave the Angels a 5-4 win. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
I want a warm fleece on a cool day.
I want to be a bike that races around the country.
I want to be a bench on a forest trail.
When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. Brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide. But only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
The traditional light bulb, a groundbreaking invention in 1879. It's time we switch to longer-lasting Energy Star light bulbs. They're more efficient than the old bulbs, like a text message is more efficient than a carrier pigeon. And they cut down on our energy costs. Because in our own groundbreaking age, we deserve a light bulb that saves us some cash. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at EnergySavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Optafor Integrated Wealth Management. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn of Optafor. We've got a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, including Joel Birkin, Managing Partner, Reese Broom, Mike Bruce, President and CEO, InScope International, Inc., Luis Riesco, President and CEO of Lumark Technologies, Inc., and Deb Alderson, President and CEO of Sotera Defense. First up is our guest, Joel Birkin. Joel is managing partner of Reese Broom. Joel, what is Reese Broom?
Reese Broom is a law firm located here in Northern Virginia in Tyson's Corner. We have 42 lawyers.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved with the firm?
I'm one of the founders. With a law school buddy of mine and a law school buddy of his, Jim Reese and John Broom, we decided to form the law firm in 1974.
Was that the first job you had as a lawyer?
No, actually, I worked downtown for a lawyer who did immigration law for 2 years, and I also taught at GW Law School. I was a teaching fellow there for 2 years.
And so what was the impetus to basically start your own firm? What was going on?
We thought that there would be a good market here in Fairfax County for a business and tax-oriented law firm, and we thought we could do it. Three guys with no clients starting a law firm here in Virginia.
So what was the risk for you guys back then?
I had no dependents, so there was less risk for me. The other two guys were married, so, you know, if you didn't succeed, you'd have to go get a job somewhere. I didn't particularly want to work for anybody. I wanted to work for myself.
And why was that? What was it about you that said, I do better when I'm working myself or a small group of
partners?
Well,
I'm following in my father's footsteps and my grandfather's footsteps. My father had his own business, and my grandfather had his own business, and that's what I wanted to do.
What was your father's business?
My father sold and serviced scales in Westchester County, New York. That is counting scales, doctor scales, industrial scales, and had his own business, Birkin Scale Company.
Birkin Scale Company.
Yes.
So he was, and he was successful?
Well, he supported the family, raised and educated two kids, so I would say he was successful.
Mm-hmm. So did you get a chance to work with him growing up?
Yes, I did. And
what was that like for you?
Well, it was very, very good. He taught me how important the customer was and respecting the customer, and he was a very gregarious fellow, and he told me that that was an important aspect of running a business.
Did he take on sales calls?
Occasionally. One of my favorite stories about my father, if I may, is that he had a contract with Weight Watchers in White Plains, New York. Mm-hmm. The women periodically would complain about the doctor scales that they weren't working correctly.
Yeah.
Now, if anybody knows about a Detecto doctor scale, which is what he sold and serviced, you could drop them out of an eight-story window and there'd be nothing wrong with them.
Industrial strength.
It was a simple balance beam scale, but the women would complain, so he had a service contract to go repair them. And he would do that very, very publicly with all the women watching, and everybody would be happy. He would get his money. The owner of the Weight Watchers franchise would be happy, and the customers would be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically, you know, one of the things that I learned from him, try to keep everybody happy and respect the customer and what they wanted.
Is that important in what you do in business, keeping folks happy?
Yes. I mean, since most of my business is businesses, and they're mostly long-term relationships, you obviously have to have the respect of the customer, the client, and you have to do what is needed to be done, and you have to do it correctly.
So how does a father translate respect to a child? I mean, how do you pick that up? since you're using that theme?
I think you pick it up by osmosis. I mean, you just see how he deals with people and how people deal with him, mm-hmm. and you assume by osmosis that's one of the things that's very, very important in a business relationship.
And it resonated with you.
It definitely resonated with me because, I mean, my business, which is the law business, is based in large part on relationships, especially mm-hmm. if you have long-term relationships with your clients. And I think it's got to be a mutual respect. So if you tell them something, you know, they have reason to believe that what you're telling them is correct and it makes sense to them.
So it's not just technical competence, it's also personal relationship.
It's absolutely the ability to translate their legal position into a set of goals that they have mm-hmm. to achieve.
And what about Mom? What was she?
My mother was a housewife. I was told before she had kids that she worked in a law firm. She was a stenographer back in the days of shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody knows what shorthand is anymore. And she worked.
Sure, we've got some people out there. Again.
She worked for a law firm until she had kids, and then she was a housewife.
Mm-hmm. And what do you remember about her growing up?
She was fiercely in favor of education. Neither of my parents. Who graduated high school in 1932 and 1933 had the opportunity to go to college, and they were very, very focused on making sure that their two children, my older brother and me, got a good high school education and a good college education.
Why was that important to them?
Because they saw that as the pathway for success.
And so you gravitated towards that. I mean, you just didn't go to college. You have an advanced degree here. We're talking a JD, right?
Well, yes. I actually have an LLM, too, because I had a teaching fellowship at GW Law School after I graduated, and I got an LLM as well as teaching there for 2 years. But education was very, very important, and, you know, the further I went, the more mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed college a heck of a lot more than high school, and I enjoyed law school a heck of a lot more than college. And I think I'm fairly unique in that regard because most lawyers I talked to didn't like law school.
Mm-hmm. So Joel, you grew up in New York and ended up in school in D.C. What brought you here?
A very, very scientific approach. When I was looking at colleges, my father drove me down here from New York during spring break. It was freezing, perhaps even snowing in New York. And when I got down here, the daffodils were blooming and all the hedges were out. And I said, this is the place for me because it's warm. And I like that. So I went to GW.
I mean, going to GW, even back then, I can't imagine how it's one of the more expensive schools today. But your dad, you said, you know, he had his own business. Mom worked, you know, basically took care of the kids at home. How'd you pay for that stuff?
My father paid for it, and I worked summers. But back in the day, now we're talking about the 60s, I don't really wish to date myself, but I started college in 1965. GW wasn't quite as expensive as it was, mm-hmm. as it is now. Great piece of real estate, though. My goodness, what a wonderful location.
But you made a contribution? I mean, you're basically paying your expenses?
Sure. I worked during the summers, and I paid my expenses. And I also
started... And you didn't go out and buy a GTO?
No, I did not. I also started working after my junior year. I had a job in Washington. I had a job in Washington. I worked at a place in campus just doing clerical work,
mm-hmm.
and then I worked at the Department of Agriculture. I was majoring in economics, so I became an economics assistant at the Department of Agriculture.
But that wasn't your first paying job, was it?
No, my first paying job was a summer job at the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, known as the A&P,
mm-hmm.
in a meat warehouse, and I was a porter. That means I swept the floor.
Big difference between being a lawyer and sweeping the floors in the warehouse of the grocery store.
Well, I wish there was more of a difference, but sometimes as a lawyer, you're sweeping the floors and doing a lot of cleanup for your client when they get themselves into a mess.
So there is a connection between the two.
There absolutely is a connection.
How old were you when you were actually doing that work?
I was probably 18, 19 years old. New York was a union shop. I had to join the Teamsters Union. And
did you have any inclination that you were going to join the Teamsters at any point in your life?
No, I was told I had to join in order to have the job. The dues were probably a couple of bucks a week, But the best thing about the job, besides being in a cooled meat warehouse during the summer months, was the fact that it paid very, very well. I'm not sure the listeners remember what the minimum wage was in the 1960s, but it was $1.25 an hour. And I was paid, I remember this to this day, $134 a week for sweeping the floor.
Wow. What'd you do with the money?
I used it to help defray my college expenses.
Mm. What'd you learn about yourself back then, in that job in particular?
I learned that going to college was a whole lot better than sweeping the floors, but it was a means to an end. And it's very, very important to have your gratification goals set on a long-term basis, and you know, you do what you need to do in order to get where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to take you back to when you started the law firm. You were 2 years out of law school, and one of the things you mentioned in the green room is you wanted to run a firm as a business, because most lawyers were not trained. I'm a lawyer too, and I was not trained on how to run a business. How did you have the skills or the insights, and what did you learn? How did you know? You became the managing partner right away, right?
No, actually, Jim Reese was the managing partner early on. He tragically died in an airplane crash in the 1980s, and I sort of absorbed into that role. But, I mean, I understood about business, and it was really a very, very simple formula. You have to get the customers or the clients. You have to do the work. You have to send out an invoice, and you have to get paid. And it was very, very simple. And even though you're a professional and you have ethics rules that you have to follow, I mean, you still have to get paid, and you still have to do the job, and you have to do it right.
Joel, we're about at the end here. What's the website address?
For my firm?
Yeah.
ReeseBroome.com. That's ReeseBroome.com.
We've been talking with Joel Birkin, managing partner at Reese Broom. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn, for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this business spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Cassie Self, Marketing Manager, Buchanan & Edwards. Cassie, what is Buchanan & Edwards?
We are an IT consulting firm, and we are committed to bringing innovation and efficiency to our federal clients.
And what's your role in the company?
My role in the company is leading both the internal and external marketing and communications initiatives, and really connecting our employees with our executives and our management team, but then also, you know, relaying our messages to our customers.
And what do you like most about your job?
The people.
What is it about the people that makes them special?
Everybody at the company has, a certain level of excitement, and you really see their passion for helping our clients.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think your clients appreciate about the company?
I think that our clients, first, they appreciate our quality. All of our employees are really committed to helping our clients improve their business functions and bringing that level of quality.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about your work?
I would say the people again, the people that I interact with every day and the team that I work with, and being able to share our message and our solution with our clients.
That's great. Who do you think is the perfect kind of client for Buchanan Edwards?
An organization that has a lot of processes set in place that could be improved with technology, improved by bringing efficiency and automating a lot of stuff.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.buchanan-edwards.com.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Cassie Self, Marketing Manager at Buchanan & Edwards. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn. For this segment, we've got Mike Bruce, President and CEO of InScope International, Inc. Welcome. Hey, Mike, what is InScope?
InScope is a mission-driven innovation factory focused on public policy and national security issues.
What does that mean, innovation factory?
Well, what we do, we look at what are the real issues that we're facing as a country, and we bring together technology, engineering, and business individuals to tackle it. So we do a wide range of things: chronic disease management, energy efficiency for buildings, warrior support.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get started?
Got started in 2002, direct result of 9/11. I was selling sales for or selling technology for a outsourced firm. When the planes hit, it caused me to really rethink what I was doing, what I wanted to do. And in that moment, I said, I want to start a company that prevented something like this from happening again.
I want to go there in a second. How big or small is this company?
We're 150 people. We are one of the top 100 black-owned firms in the country.
That's great. So 9/11 had a huge, profound impact on you, as it did many people. But what happened for you?
Well, for me, several things happened in that moment. I'm first-generation American. Both my parents are from Guyana, South America. So they've taught me to love this country. I served in the Air Force. And I grew up as a technologist. I went to business school as well. And so in that moment, I said, what can I do? What's a creative response to such a national, in fact, a global tragedy? And so to be able to start a company that got to the root of that problem is something that it was just very natural. It was something that spoke to me.
And the nature of the work you do, what's the significance of that for you?
Well, we really look at what type of impact can we have in the lives of people, both from a quality of life standpoint. So therefore, our healthcare business, for example, we're targeting individuals with chronic disease as well as national security issues. What we're working in alongside of warfighters to keep them safe.
So personally, take us back. You said your parents were immigrants. They came here. How old were you at the time?
They came in the 60s, and I was born here in 71. And so I wasn't a part of the journey, but it was certainly part of my upbringing, seeing them work hard, bringing their family members over to the States.
I mean, most people, you know, today we get on a plane, we come over here, and things are firm and set up. You got a place to go. What was that like for them?
Oh, it was dramatic. My dad is legally deaf. And so they actually first went to the UK. Guyana is a British colony. He was unable to find work. He came to America, separated, not married a little bit, physically for 2 years from my mom to make a way here, sent for my mom, and then sent for more family from Guyana. And that, through my entire upbringing, we saw all my aunts and uncles come one after another.
How does someone, your dad in this case, what keeps him going to make that happen? I mean, you're talking about bringing a lot of people over.
Yeah. It's a sense of relationship, sense of community. Family was a big part of their culture. They wanted to make sure that they made a better way for themselves. And they, once they achieved that, they wanted to make sure that they shared that with as many people as possible. So many people helped my dad, and he just turned around and paid it forward with my relatives. And that's something that continues to me and what I'm trying to do with the company.
Mm-hmm. What was your dad doing back then?
He was a carpenter in Guyana. And so he and my grandfather actually had their own cabinetry shop. And my dad came without a high school education, learned how to become a draftsman, and ultimately was an engineer at Johnson & Johnson, all without a high school education.
Really?
Absolutely. Something that can't be done today.
Is he still with us?
He is still with us. My mom and my dad both moved down to Florida a couple years ago.
Uh-huh. So your experience of him as from a business standpoint, what did he instill in you?
Well, he was extraordinarily frugal, but at the same time, he gave generously. And so that's something that I learned.
That's a paradox of sorts, isn't it?
Well, it's about stewardship, and then what do you do with it? So it's not just a matter of capturing and hoarding. It's a matter of being very wise with it so that you can share and be generous with others.
Is he surprised by your success today? And I know we talked about what success is, so why don't you actually tell us your definition?
Absolutely. So my definition of success is not measured in terms of money. It's impact in the community. My dad would say that he saw this coming. He always wanted his children to do better for himself, and that's how he measures success. And so I think we're both successful.
You're the younger of
two.
Two.
That's right.
So what did he see in you that actually, this really doesn't necessarily surprise him, but what did he see in you?
Well, it's interesting. My brother's been laser focused. So he's in the healthcare arena. I had a diverse number of interests. And so the fact that I've got a company that dabbles in so many different areas doesn't surprise him at all. But I'm driven by my passion, and that hard work and dedication is what makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. That's great. What about mom?
Mom's a nurse. She retired for about 2 months when the hospital in New Jersey shut down. As soon as she moved down to Florida, she went right back to it. Retirement is not in her language. But she's all about education. She always says, if you think that education is expensive, try ignorance.
That's powerful. That's great. So where do you get your drive from? Where does this come from?
Again, a number of places. I saw it in my family upbringing. I saw it certainly in the military, being committed to a cause, being committed to the flag no matter what. And then I see it in the people. I see a wonderful generation that's coming into the workforce that it's not just about the money. It's about the triple bottom line. Mm-hmm. Good for profit, good for the planet, good for people.
That's excellent. Something that you said earlier, you told us a story about Skylab. So can you kind of give us the upshot of that? Why was the significance of Skylab? What was the significance of Skylab for you?
Yeah, so in the mid-80s when Skylab fell, it caught my attention. I was always a stargazer. I loved studying the planets. It surprised me that there was a laboratory up in space. And so when it came down, when it fell out of orbit, I wanted to know why. And that was the early days of bulletin boards. And so I went online, learned as much as I could about the space program, which is why ultimately I wanted to become an astronaut.
You wanted, but you're not an astronaut, are you?
I am not an astronaut.
Not right now, at least.
Not right now, although that's still in the future. I went to MIT on an Air Force scholarship to study aerospace engineering. When I was in my major, my sophomore year, I realized that aerospace was not about flying. It was about building the planes, and I was not an engineer that way. I was a computer scientist, and that's why I ended up studying. But it was that difference between understanding the systems versus actually constructing the vehicles that caused a change.
So you've got this explorer blood in you, so to speak.
Absolutely.
How does it show up for you today and how you lead an organization?
Well, I mentioned the company is mission-driven. We're very intentional. We don't talk about our capabilities. It's not about software development or financial intelligence. What are the things that drive us? What are our passions? And then let's identify whether it's a company to buy, a technology to lease, or something that we can build that truly solves our problem. So the discovery comes from identifying those core issues that we're passionate about and then finding a relevant solution that we can build and bring to market.
Go ahead, Mark.
So, Mike, I want to ask you about that a little bit more. Also in the agreement, you mentioned how mission was so important. But the more conventional definition of success in terms of profitability and so on, there's got to be pressure in that regard. So how do you reconcile having a successful company the way you define it and a successful company the way most people would define it?
Well, I've become a huge student of American business. And I look at the Industrial Revolution in the turn of the century. Rockefeller is a favorite of mine, a titan. And he was absolutely ruthless as a businessman and ruthless to his competitors. But to his people, he was loved. And so that paradox of how can you be a consummate business person that's ruthlessly focused on the bottom line, but yet cares about your family and cares about your community is something that I'm trying to embrace myself in our company.
Which you've had two excellent role models teach you.
And they continue to teach me every day.
Your older brother. You said he was kind of laser focused in the corporate world, healthcare. I think you said.
That's right.
What does he think of your success, by your definition? What do you think of that?
Well, it's great. We were both athletes. We both played soccer through college. When we're on the field, we are cutthroat and we compete head to head. When it comes to business, we're there to support one another. I envy him because he has the resources of a giant conglomerate. He envies me because I have the flexibility of an entrepreneur. And so we're always helping each other. And it's amazing, a small company and a large company, as different we are as we are, it's about people and how we deal with them. And so we share a lot and we support each other in pretty big ways.
I got one other question for you just real quickly. You know, you made a switch, you said, in college, and that's no small, easy thing, especially,
yeah.
I think you said you're on scholarship at
that
time?
Yeah, an Air Force scholarship, yes.
Huge risk. And you turned to something completely different?
Absolutely. There's two stories that speak to me. One, my freshman year, there was a minority developer who worked with students, Dean Pitts. I walked into her office, and she said, and I was waiting outside her office. This is MIT, mind you. This is engineers. I was chatting up everybody in the room. I was talking to the receptionist. As I walked in her office, she turned to me and said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "What do you mean? You have too much personality." So number one, I recognized that I needed to be around people. And so that was a major, major influence for me.
That's great. I wish we had time for more. Mike, what's the website address?
www.inscopeinternational.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Bruce, President and CEO of InScope International, Inc. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn, for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Isabella Fuentes, Marketing Director at BusinessWise CPAs. Isabella, what is BusinessWise CPAs?
BusinessWise CPA supports government contractors, small businesses, and nonprofits with outsourced CFO and financial consulting services.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the marketing director.
And as a marketing director, what does that mean?
Well, I actually wear several hats. My primary role is to improve and extend the branding of BusinessWise CPA through referrals, client meetings, networking in the DC area, as well as supporting current client relationships.
And what do you like most about your job?
I like the most that I don't have to be at a desk all day. I'm out and about meeting new folks and learning experiences from other entrepreneurs.
Great. What makes your organization so special in your view?
I believe our added value is that we are not just a number report kind of type firm. We're very much integrated with our clients. They rely on us for all important decisions. We help them not only with the numbers, but on the future growth of the business.
And what is it that the clients appreciate most about the company?
That they can call us and they talk to the same person every time.
Okay, and who's the perfect client?
Perfect client is small to mid-size organization looking to save on a full-time employee and as well as get the added value of the consulting.
Great. What's the website for the company?
www.businesswisecpa.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Isabella Fuentes, Marketing Director at BusinessWise CPAs. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Colin Callahan. Up next, we have Jim Norris, President and CEO of Montgomery County Employees Federal Credit Union. Jim, what is Montgomery County Employees Federal Credit Union?
Well, thanks for having me here today. I really appreciate it. And our credit union provides financial services to the employees of Montgomery County and also the Montgomery County public school employees, and we also offer our services to several other groups.
And how big or small is it?
So we're approaching $100 million in assets. We're very excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And been around for how long, the association?
So it's been around since 1968, and a group of Montgomery County employees actually founded the credit union in the personnel department over at the county.
Mm-hmm. And how did you become president and CEO?
So I interviewed for the position. And interviews really excite me. I really love to prepare. I like to find out all I can about the company, and that's what I did. In this case, I prepared. I had a vision. I came in, and the board interviewed me. And I not only had the vision, but I had steps of how I was, you know, planning to get there.
So how did preparation become so important in what you do and what you bring to the table?
Just, you know, I think to be proactive, I always like to be proactive and, you know, putting together the pieces of the puzzle. And, you know, it's really because of the vision. So I'm always thinking, okay, what steps do I need to get to get there?
Mm-hmm. How young were you when you first started preparing for things like that, that deep preparation and curiosity?
Gosh, that was probably when I was about 12 years old, you know, paper routes you know, doing all kind of things. I was never, you know, one to kind of sit around. I needed to be out, be doing something. So, you know.
I mean, nobody was making you do that.
Nobody was making me do it. You know, get out, get the paper route, not only the paper route, but, you know, interacting with the customers and, you know, how can I do things better for those folks.
You were doing that at 12?
12.
What did you learn at 12 that is still with you about how you go about your business today?
I think it's really about the interaction and the small things that the small steps that you take can really amount to a huge difference in the long run.
Mm-hmm. You also told us about taking stuff apart as a kid.
Love it.
What resonates for me about that is that you see things as a system. That's true about cars. And how's that true for organizations?
Everything's a system. Everything that we do is a system, and everything is an interaction. So there's so many cogs that run a system. And I think the way I look at things is I like to take them apart so I can put them back together and be better, more efficient, more effective.
Where'd you learn to do that? What's the first thing you took apart and tried to put back together?
Gosh, first thing that I took apart was a really old TV, had a remote control, and it was a mechanical remote control. I was like, I need to figure out how this thing works.
To figure that out.
I was like, how does it work? Uh-huh. What makes it go?
Where's that curiosity come from?
I don't know. It's fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. It feels like a real passion that whole
it is,
system.
It's a passion. You're right about mm-hmm. that. And, I enjoy it.
So where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Baltimore, mm-hmm. Maryland.
And how many brothers and sisters?
Got seven of us.
Wow. And yes. You are the oldest boy?
So I'm the oldest boy. In the middle, that's right. I've got two older sisters.
What was that like?
It was great. My sisters are crazy. They're fun. we always are together. We're just great friends. And
I suppose there's a certain amount of system dynamics in growing up in a family that big. So not just our things systems, but
yeah, it's dynamics. Interesting that you should mention that. When we moved, and there was a dishwasher in our house, and it broke early on. My parents didn't get it fixed. And
what did you do with it?
They wouldn't let me touch it. They said, that's actually where our snacks were. All the different, boxes of snacks actually ended up in the dishwasher. Uh-huh. But we had a system actually where one of the kids would clear the table, one would, wash the dishes, the other would dry the dishes, the other would put them away. Uh-huh. So everything had a system.
Right. So you saw it right early on, how to organize people to get stuff going.
I hadn't thought about that for years. You just brought that to my attention.
Were there other things like that growing up?
There's always a system. Mm-hmm. Coming in at night. Coming in at night, we had to sign. We had a sign-in list. So whoever was the last one to sign in, they're the ones that locked up the house. Mm-hmm. That's just another example.
So it's kind of all
system.
Over the place. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that why? Is what's the need in you that actually compels that?
Well, I think it's like I mentioned the vision.
Yeah.
So I had this vision.
I'm thinking about even when you're younger. What is it that happened to you, whether it was maybe your first paying job or something else, that said this is important?
I think it was really maybe about the input from other people. When something got fixed or was gleaming like new, it was the input of other people that really kind of motivates me. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that's really cool. I want to, how did you do that? Oh, I did that. Boom, boom, boom.
I mean, you described a situation earlier where the kids are all sitting around the dinner table, and this is where it happens. You're one of seven eventually. and I'm trying to figure out, so is this curiosity, this need to understand how things work and an interest in kind of putting your hands into it, getting, as we say, rolling up the sleeves and getting dirty, does that come from being around the table and being that one of seven, or does it come from someplace else?
I think maybe it does come from being, one of seven. We all have to work. We just can't sit around. We have to work to, get the house in order, et cetera. So we always had a job to do.
So who was the one who was maintaining the order in the house for those kinds of things?
Oh, that's Dad.
That was Dad?
Dad was the order guy. Yeah. Yes.
What did Dad do?
He scared us. He scared us. But he was very caring, and but he was the order guy, and Mom was the okay, let's make it better, person.
So. In your business today, as you're running the credit union, are you more like your mom or your dad in your leadership style?
It's a mix, but I would say that I'm more my mom.
Uh-huh.
Because I like to have fun. I like to be passionate about something. I like for folks to be interested in what they're doing
and make it better.
So I always have to kind of make it fun.
Uh-huh.
And that I think that attracts people.
How young were you when you first had a leadership position in a credit union?
So I was 22 years old. I was just coming out
22.
Of 22. I was just coming out of University of Maryland. I had just graduated, didn't have a job, and I didn't even know what a credit union was. But there was an opportunity, and I took it. And here I am 33 years later.
What did they see in you back then?
I think they saw a guy that liked to take things apart and didn't have fear.
No fear.
The opportunity, the credit union had some challenges. And they felt that I was up for those challenges.
But you're 22 years old or thereabouts. You don't have a whole lot of work experience behind you?
No.
That's a big risk for an institution to take that's not in the business of taking huge risks.
That is very true. That is very true. They saw something, and I didn't let them down. I took over, and right from the get-go, I worked to, turn things around.
What was the biggest surprise? All of a sudden, you're in charge of people and their paychecks and that kind of thing. What was the biggest surprise running the business?
Well, the biggest surprise was really all the paperwork that had to be done and the regulatory burdens. So that was really some of the issues. Within my first month, I had the NCUA regulator come in, and here I am, 22 years old.
Yeah,
I had no idea, and we had to go through a regulatory exam.
So what did you draw upon back? What did you draw upon from your childhood that enabled you to kind of get through that process?
Let's see. Wow. Let me think about that one. I think it was get the job done. We need to. No excuses. I think that was one of Dad's things. Like, look, just get it done. And I needed to get it done, whatever it took, whether it was calling on other folks that knew more than I did. I needed to make it happen. And that was, again, here's the vision. Now I need to make it go.
Did you learn anything about yourself in the process there that maybe surprised you, that you still rely upon today?
I think the one thing that I found was is relying on other folks and making them part of the process, and really motivating them and drawing on their experiences, and I still do that. Everyone has so much to offer, and I really take advantage of everybody's input.
Is that the way it was around the dinner table? Everybody has something to contribute?
Everyone had something to contribute, and Mom and Dad listened.
And getting the dishes washed.
Yeah, exactly. Part of that system.
Got to be done.
is there anything for you, as you look at the role that you're playing today, anything that to you kind of represents the next big challenge for you?
That's a great question, and I think the next big challenge is things are moving so fast. The internet, the mobile, and it's really trying to keep up with what's the next greatest thing that's going to happen. And, I don't want to end up as a Blockbuster. So, we need to really keep up and make sure that we're hitting on that next big thing.
That's great. What's the website?
So the website is mcefcu.org.
Thank you, Jim. We've been speaking with Jim Norris, President and CEO of Montgomery County Employees Federal Credit Union. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this Business Spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn and Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn and Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn and Burnett so special?
We are
first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're the one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohen & Burnett?
CohenAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A-N-D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohen, founder of Cohen & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohen. For this segment, we've got Luis Riesco, President and CEO, Lumark Technologies, Inc. Welcome. Luis, what is Lumark?
Yes, Les. Lumark is a professional services company. We focus on federal clients, and we also have a commercial practice.
How big or small?
We're a small business, about 30 employees and about a half dozen consultants.
And how'd you get a job with them?
Well, it's kind of goes back quite a bit, but actually 2002 is when I started full-time with the company itself.
So you didn't start the company?
Actually, I did.
Oh, you did?
Founded in 99, basically employee number one, zero budget, no clients, and started from ground up.
And why? I mean, of all the things you could have been doing, why'd you pick this and go out on your own?
Sure. You know, it goes back a little bit. I'd been working for 3 8As, basically for 8 years, and frankly, when I got to the second 8A, great opportunity, learned a lot about business itself, was doing well as far as bringing in new business, and I thought, well, you know what, I could probably do this on my own. So incorporated going into the third 8A business, and then at that point said, you know what, it's time to break off on my own.
Just for some of our listeners, what's an 8A?
Oh, I'm sorry. 8A is a program. The SBA sponsors it, and it's basically a 10-year period where you get a little bit of assistance or preference in federal government contracts. So it allows us basically to kind of compete a little bit more on a smaller pool of companies.
And so what is it about running a business that you bring that's uniquely the gift that you have?
Sure.
Where the greatest contribution happens?
I think, you know, it's all about people and being able to bridge people together, communication, you know, and frankly, honesty comes into play. You know, I'm the big advocate of just having an open table, frank discussion. And starting with employee number one, I mean, the first thing was trying to get client number one. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do that, again, initially as consulting, over time, building a little past performance. And then in 2007, about 4 years into the business, landing the first prime contract, which we hired six people, and that's really when we became a company.
Did you ever have any idea that you would be successful doing it, or was there any doubt?
I would say doubt probably didn't enter it. It was just one of those, you know, I've been driven since I was a kid. It's one of those things, my whole background, I am the oldest child.
Oldest of how many?
Oldest of two other brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's one of those motivating things where, you know, as the oldest, you're kind of expected to pave the plan, you know, the way forward. So I went to college, got a degree, actually got 2 degrees.
Were you the first of your siblings to go?
I was, yeah.
What about in the family?
My father actually did have I believe what's equivalent of a master's education. He's from Argentina. My mom's from Chile.
So they weren't born here?
No. I am the first generation here born. And, so I think, good upbringing as a kid, discipline.
How old were you when they came here?
I was young. Actually, I was born here in 64, so they just had moved here, or my father originally moved here to take a job here as an electrical engineer in 63.
Hmm.
So you said you were driven from the start. Where did that come from?
Okay. You know, my natural passion was always kind of I wanted to see an end-to-end pretty much in work itself. So I initially started actually down a technical route. I've got a bachelor's in computer science and in chemistry, and so I started in kind of that technical track, but soon, you know, got promoted to management. Quickly, my you know, managers basically said, hey, this guy can write, he can talk. Clients love him, and let's get him into BD. And soon enough, after a few years of that, growing business, it became natural.
Where did the gift for communication skills, both the written and the verbal, come from?
Sure. When you're a child and you are born of Hispanic parents or foreign parents, typically you're gonna learn that language. So I was fluent in Spanish. In fact, my mom still has tapes of me, you know, when I spoke as a little kid. It's pretty impressive.
What's it like to listen to yourself back then?
It's wild. It's wow, that was me. And here I am now, you know, not much with an accent, but it took time. I mean, up through grade school and even to high school, you know, that's kind of when the reality came into play about, you know, how important English, you know, both from, you know, verbal and writing. And it wasn't until college that I actually really got, you know, proficient and got to the point where, you know, writing proposals these days, I mean, it is probably one of my greatest strengths.
Really? So My Fair Lady was right. In other words,
absolutely.
The way you speak is going to control your fate.
Yep. And it's also, I think, the way that you present yourself too. I mean, people are drawn, I think, naturally to people who are going to sit down and talk to you as a person with respect, with dignity, but also openness.
Mm-hmm. Was it, did they speak Spanish in the house?
Absolutely. Yeah, and they still do. So it's kind of the funny conversation. You know, they speak to me in Spanish. I reply back in English. But these days, actually, to kind of brush up on my Spanish, I'm actually trying to speak more Spanish.
Uh-huh. And is it the same with your brothers?
It is. We play upon that fact because it is, you know, as and again, foreign kids, first generation. I mean, it's a skill and in some ways even just a little bit of an advantage these days with, you know, so many different languages in business, especially.
And back in that period that you were referring to, I think you said the 60s?
Mm-hmm.
Was speaking English or speaking Spanish the thing that you needed to do in order to kind of fit in, so to speak?
Well, and maybe that's probably part of what drove me too. You know, in the early days speaking Spanish around Spanish families where we, you know, pretty much hung together, that was great. We were family, you know, it was easy. Around English, you know, American, it was tough, you know, because they're hearing you speak Spanish and it gets tough as a kid with an accent. But again, as you can hear me today, you know, the accents moved on. And
was there some moment back then that may have had a pivotal impact on you in terms of that communication?
Sure. When you get, I hate to say it, when you get kind of critiqued on your accent and your heritage, that kind of draws you a little bit to say, you know what, I'm going to perfect this skill.
Does that move you towards or away from, you know, what it is that people in that group and that society and that culture that you grew up in?
You know, I think it makes you stronger, actually. I don't think it moves you away. In fact, I think it gets you a little bit deeper in understanding what it's like to be in a different community, you know, with the language itself or for those who aren't speaking that language.
So you didn't recoil from that at
all? No, on the contrary. In fact, in some ways, it's almost a passion. I mean, the ability to communicate in different languages, it's a whole nother world you get to to experience. And I'll tell you, it's been a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier it was a little bit of a challenge.
How important is it in what you do now?
I think it's really important because, and it doesn't matter whether it's Spanish, any language, you know, when you meet someone, you know, you can obviously tell that's of a foreign descent or has a foreign language, you know, you actually can communicate, I think, a little bit easier because you can actually understand them. You can also, I think, appreciate that, you know, that they have another language, you know, that they bring to the table too. And it's, I think there's a genuine openness too. Mm-hmm. Of attraction there that, you know, hey, it isn't all just, and this sounds very, very demeaning, but I don't mean no disrespect, but, you know, those of the same language, you know, can obviously easily communicate. Those of different languages, it takes a little extra effort. Which
you got to work harder.
You got to work harder, and there's a little, I think, more genuine sincerity in there, too.
Yeah, and you said earlier that you got that from your mom. Your mom was the talker in the family.
Absolutely.
What was she doing?
Yep. Yeah, well, she worked actually at ShopRite, basically a food grocery type chain, mm-hmm. for years. And those who know my mom, I mean, yeah, she was a talker and still is a talker. I'm lucky to have both my parents still with me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your parents sheltered you a lot growing up. And then you got to college and sort of had your eyes open. What did you learn in that regard when you got to college?
Sure. And the sheltering, you know, it's the typical, I mean, of any type of foreign descent. I think it's your mom protecting you. It's your father, you know, kind of protecting you. And, yeah, in a lot of ways kind of keeping us focused on, you know, hey, education first, you know, being good stand-up kids. But it wasn't really till college where you're on your own and you really kind of start looking at things a little bit more clearly.
Were they protective?
protective to the sense of not keeping me back or restrained, but protective in the sense of not seeing things really clearly. And that's a whole discussion by itself.
Yeah. When did that change for you?
Oh, college for sure.
What happened?
Basically, you know, they're not there. So, you know, then, you know, when you'll read the news, you'll interact with, and also it was an opportunity to meet a lot of different people from many, many different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Obviously.
Where did you go to school?
I went my undergrad at Mary Washington University. Or used to be actually Mary Washington College mm-hmm. when I went there, and got a graduate degree at George Mason University.
So education, where did the theme of education show up for you growing up?
Always with me from day one. My mom's father actually was a well-known chemist in Chile, so that to me was sort of where I was driven. That was originally the track I was going down. I thought I was going to be a chemist growing up. And
so you'd be working for what, Coca-Cola, just new formula?
Absolutely. Who knows? In fact, maybe even taking a job maybe in Chile. I mean, it's one of those things that had a lot of opportunity. Mm. But it there came
in this country or Chile?
In both. But I chose kind of, I was actually, to be honest, it wasn't motivating me. So I ended up actually changing careers a little bit. I got a computer science degree.
When did you make that change?
Third year in college, and stayed a couple extra years actually to get the second degree.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Was that a hard decision to make?
It was. It really was, because, you know, but I finished the chemistry degree. It's one of those things, and I think maybe that's a little bit more of a testament of just what I drive for. If I start something, I'm not going to just drop it and walk away.
Mm-hmm. What was the thing about your dad? You said he was an electrical engineer. He was kind of quiet.
Yeah.
What is it that you kind of got from him?
You know, I think probably, you know, his technical capability, his drive actually to, you know, to look for solutions, problem solving. I mean, he was an engineer by nature. So, you know, growing up, we did a lot of things together. He showed us, you know, how to build a model airplane. I mean, we're out there playing, you know, he's kicking the ball, teaching us soccer, you know, again, soccer these days, very long. But I think also with his language challenge, I mean, to be honest, I think it did actually inhibit, you know, some of his career growth. So for me as a kid, seeing this, that kind of gave me a little extra drive to kind of overcome that. And that's where, you know, a lot of this actually, you know, came from, starting a business.
So you had a very technical background, chemistry, then computer sciences. But right now you're actually running a company. Where did you pick up your skills to learn how to run a company?
Yep.
Let's do this quickly as
sure.
we can here.
Absolutely. Basically, I had the opportunity to work for an 8A. Again, that's a small business. The first one, you know, I basically got into proposal development, business development, learned about basically capturing new business. The second one actually was a really good opportunity. I learned about the corporate infrastructure. I was brought in and allowed actually to learn about HR, legal, security, finance. So it helped basically, you know, give me some lessons learned. If I was to start a new business, I had at least some experience in those areas.
I wish we had more time. This is still a very interesting conversation, but we're running out of time. So what's the website address, Luis?
Sure. It's www.lumark, that's lumark.com.
We've been speaking with Luis Riesco, President and CEO, Lumark Technologies, Inc. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today. First up was Joel Berkin, Managing Partner, Reese Broom. We had Mike Bruce, President and CEO of InScope International, Luis Riesco, President and CEO of Lumark Technologies, and Deb Alderson, President and CEO of Soterra Defense. This is your host, Les Smolin, and I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn, for helping with the interviews, hopefully delivering to our listening audience an entertaining and educational show. And I'd like to thank our listening audience for listening, otherwise we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can also hear this program again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.